On December 3rd, 2024, Peter M. Sandman gave a keynote presentation via Zoom to the annual conference of the Australian Institute of Occupational Hygienists, meeting in Perth, Western Australia. He summarized his basic approach to risk communication in 25 minutes, with a bit more emphasis on outrage management. Another 23 minutes of Q&A followed. According to Dr. Sandman, this is worth posting mostly because it's short and recent. Except for the Q&A, there's nothing new here.
Welcome to our next session. And it's safe to say that our next speaker, Peter Sandman, is a risk communication legend. Creator of the risk equals hazard plus outrage formula of risk communication, Dr. Sandman is one of the world's preeminent risk communication speakers and consultants, although now he identifies as semi-retired. He is best known for his unique and effective approach to calming upset stakeholders in low-hazard, high-outrage risk controversies. But he's also worked on how to convince apathetic people to take precautions, for example, wearing seatbelts in high hazard, low outrage situations, and on how to guide appropriately upset people through high hazard, high outrage situations, for example, in a pandemic. Today, we're lucky to have Peter running through some basics on risk communication, followed by a live Q&A, where you will have the opportunity to ask questions from the floor. A fun fact about Peter is that he lives on a ship and is constantly travelling the globe. Our email exchanges over the last 12 months have generally included a salutation or sign-off revealing his whereabouts and making us a little envious in the process. Some examples have included all the best from Baffin Island, which I learnt later is in the Canadian Arctic. We are currently at sea en route from Bali to Darwin. All the best from the Kimberley. Sorry about the delay, I was busy in various Fijian islands. And send me a few proposed dates and times, bearing in mind that in the next few days, I'll be in Samoa. Today, Peter is joining us from Honolulu, Hawaii. Such is the life of a semi-retired risk communication legend. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Peter Sandman.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm assuming that you can hear me. If you can't hear me, somebody signal that. But absent a signal, I'm going to figure that I'm being heard. Thank you so much for bringing me in. I wish I were there in person. I'm almost entirely retired now, but in the 40 plus years that I was working full time as a consultant, by far my favorite place to be was Australia. Quite apart from liking Australia, I like the reaction of Australia to my work. And it has something to do with the tall poppy syndrome, I think. Australians find my approach to risk communication better than most other cultures around the world. So I'm delighted to come, you know, for an hour out of retirement and talk to an audience of Australian industrial hygienists. As Dave said, I'm going to give an introduction to risk communication or to my approach to risk communication for about 20 minutes. And if I run longer than 20 minutes, Dave has promised to tell me to shut up and move to the Q&A. I will front load the things I most want to say so that when I run out of time, I've said what's most important to me. And then that should leave another 20 minutes or so for Q&A. So first slide, please. Yeah, that one's not very important. So second slide, please. Next slide. This is the traditional definition of risk. I think it's what certainly engineers and risk assessors, and I think most industrial hygienists mean when they say risk. It's a multiplication of magnitude times probability. You get your best measure of how bad it is if it happens. You get your best measure of how likely it is to happen. You multiply them by each other, and you come out with something like expected annual mortality. And you have a future in risk assessment if you can say expected annual mortality with a smile. Back in the 1980s, I came up with an alternative definition of risk, which has sent my children to college and looks like it's going to send my children to my grandchildren rather to college as well. So next slide, please. And here is the alternative definition. As Dave already signaled to you, risk is equal to hazard plus outrage. Now, technical people hate that plus sign. So when I talk to engineers, I have an alternative version. I say risk is a function of hazard and outrage. That's hazard plus outrage in their code. And they like that much better. The word outrage is problematic as well. It works fine for controversies over environmental issues, for example. It doesn't work quite as well for something like a pandemic. What I mean by outrage is anything that gets you upset. So the hazard is how endangered you are, and the outrage is how upset you are. Now, what's most important about this relationship between hazard and outrage is that there's virtually no relationship between hazard and outrage. The correlation between the two variables is approximately 0.2. Those of you who have studied statistics may remember you can square a correlation to get the amount of variance accounted for a glorious 4% of the variance. Or, and here it is without numbers, the risks that kill people and the risks that upset people are completely different. Okay, now what's important here is that although the hazard and outrage correlation is very low, essentially no correlation at all, the correlation between hazard and perceived hazard is also low. But the correlation between outrage and perceived hazard is quite high. It's about 0.7, accounting for roughly half the variance. Now, pause and think about that for a minute. There's almost no relationship between whether the risk upsets you and whether it endangers you. There's almost no relationship between whether it endangers you and whether you think it endangers you. But there's a good strong relationship between whether it upsets you and you think it endangers you. Well, whenever you have a high correlation, the first thing you want to know, if you're any kind of scientist at all, is what's the structure of the causality? So when we look at the relationship between outrage and hazard perception, what we most want to know is, are people upset because they think it's dangerous? Or do people think it's dangerous because they're upset? And there's been a lot of research on that, and the answer in a nutshell is it's a cycle. There are arrows in both directions, but the arrow from hazard perception to outrage is surprisingly weak, and the arrow from outrage to hazard perception is very strong. That is, for the most part, it is not true that people are upset because they think something is dangerous. It is much more true that people think something is dangerous because they're upset. Outrage is the engine of hazard perception. Hazard perception is not the engine of outrage. Okay, and off in a corner we have actual hazard, which isn't the engine of anything. Now, Lord knows, in talking to a room full of industrial hygienists, I'm not saying don't worry about the hazard. Of course, you have lots of reasons to worry about the hazard, but when you're trying to manage the hazard perception, when the hazard is essentially irrelevant. So, what's most important here is no relationship between hazard and outrage, but a very strong relationship between hazard perception and outrage, and in that relationship, outrage is mostly the cause, and hazard perception is mostly the effect. It follows from that it's not very sensible to try to calm people down by telling them the hazard is low. That amounts to trying to manage the cause by manipulating the effect. And that, that's crappy engineering, and it's crappy industrial hygiene, and it's crappy risk communication. What you need to do if you want to calm people down, or let me put it a different way, what you need to do if you want people to think the hazard is low is calm them down. And what you need to do if you want people to think the hazard is high is get them more upset. Outrage is what's mostly causing hazard perception. Okay, next slide, please. Based on what we've said so far, let's look at, let's graph hazard against outrage. And what I want to point you to is the four orange circles here, the four relationships between hazard and outrage that are important to risk communication. And we will start down in the lower right-hand corner with precaution advocacy, that is high hazard, low outrage. Might be smoking, might be drinking, might be driving without a seatbelt, things that kill people without getting them very upset. The label I've given to this is precaution advocacy. The paradigm is watch out. This is the venue of health communication and safety communication. You're trying to warn people about a serious risk that they're not taking seriously enough. And if I had a day instead of 20 minutes, I would spend an hour talking about how you do precaution advocacy. It's got to be short. Your messages have to be short. You have to repeat them. You have to keep them simple. You have to make them interesting, because after all, the essence of low outrage is apathy, and apathetic people are hard to talk to. In the opposite corner is outrage management. This is the venue when outrage is high and hazard is low. People are very upset, but not very endangered. And I probably earned my reputation more in the venue of outrage management than in the other aspects of this risk communication graph. And I'm going to come back to it insofar as I have time in a few minutes. But let me just say, by way of introduction, the essence of outrage management is calm down. That's the paradigm, but that's never the message, because calm down is not a calming message. When you tell people who are upset to calm down, they get more upset. They think you're being patronizing, which indeed you are. Calm down is not a good message, but calm down is the paradigm. It's the opposite of watch out. In precaution advocacy, you're trying to get people more upset. That's what that arrow means. In outrage management, you're trying to get them less upset. And again, bear in mind, the reason for those arrows is because you understand the causal structure you're working with. In precaution advocacy, you want to get them more upset so they'll think the risk is more serious, so they'll be more inclined to take precautions. In outrage management, you're trying to get them less upset, so they'll think the risk is less serious, so that they'll stop trying to take precautions or demand that you take precautions that you think are unnecessary. Okay, in the upper right-hand corner, we have crisis communication. People are rightly upset about a risk that's genuinely serious. And this is a third paradigm, and it's a third toolkit. And there's no arrow. You don't need to get people upset. They already are. You have no business trying to get people less upset, because they're right to be upset. But there's still risk communication to be done. In crisis communication, you're trying to help them bear the situation. You're trying to help them bear their outrage, and you're trying to help them decide to make wise rather than unwise decisions about what to do about it. You want them to take precautions. They want to take precautions because high outrage makes you want to take precautions, but they don't necessarily know which are the right precautions, and they may do the wrong things altogether. So there's still risk communication to be done in crisis communication, but there's no arrow. You're not trying to raise the outrage. You're not trying to reduce the outrage. Down in the bottom left-hand corner, I haven't put a circle there because I haven't found any way to earn a living there. That's low hazard, low outrage. People are rightly apathetic about a risk that's genuinely not serious. And in my judgment, there's no risk communication to be done. What would you say to them? Congratulations on your apathy. And finally, in the middle of this graph, we have what I used to call the sweet spot, and what might more respectfully be called a stakeholder consultation. People are upset enough to be interested, but not upset enough to be freaking out. The hazard is serious enough that you have reason to want to talk to them, but not so serious that you have to, mobilize them and evacuate them and get them to take urgent precautions. This is where you can chat amiably with interested stakeholders about a risk that's worth talking about, but not terribly urgent. I haven't earned much of my living in stakeholder consultation either, but there are people who do. Nobody earns their living, I think, down in the lower left-hand corner. So that's the map. And if you get nothing else out of this hour, what I want you to get out of this hour is these are four different kinds of risk communication for which there are four different toolkits. So if you want to do risk communication, the first thing you do is figure out where you are on the map. How high is the outrage? How high is the hazard? And it's, these may change over time, so you may be interested in how high is the hazard going to be. The hurricane is 3 days away, but pretty soon it's going to be serious. How high is the outrage going to be? The activists have just come into town and they're starting to mobilize community outrage. Put a time element in here, but you're figuring out how high the hazard and the outrage are or will be, and on that basis you're deciding where you are on the map, and on that basis you're deciding what toolkit to use. I haven't told you much about these toolkits, and if you want to know more, my website has a separate department, separate lists of things to read on each of these four, well, particularly on each of the three corners on outrage management, crisis communication, and precaution advocacy. Let me summarize this briefly. Next slide, please. Here are the four paradigms. If hazard is high and outrage is low, you're in the venue of precaution advocacy. The paradigm is watch out. If outrage is high and hazard is low, it's calm down, outrage management. And again, calm down is not the message. If hazard and outrage are both high, that's crisis communication. Your core paradigm there is, well, we'll get through this together. You're helping people bear it, and you're helping people decide how to manage it. And then finally, right in the middle of the graph, we have stakeholder consultation, what I usually call the sweet spot. Let's sit down and figure this out together. So what you want to do in risk communication is assess the hazard, assess the outrage, figure out for these stakeholders, for particular stakeholders at a particular moment in time, where are you on the map and what toolkit do you need? Next slide, please. Very quickly, I want to put a little bit of meat on the bones with whatever time I have left. These are the 12 principal outrage components. And you can do a kind of quick and dirty outrage assessment if you're looking at a risk and you're trying to figure out how upset people are likely to be. I say likely to be because it's easy to tell how upset they are. How many rocks did they throw at your car? How loudly are they yelling at you at the public meeting? It's not hard to figure out how high app, outrages that's already happening. But you're interested in latent outrage, and these components help you understand that. Is the risk voluntary, natural, familiar, not memorable, not dreaded, chronic, knowable, and so on down the rest of the list? If it is, people are going to be calm even if they're highly endangered. If it's coerced, industrial, exotic, memorable, dreaded, and so on down the other side of the list, they are very likely at least to be upset, even if they're not endangered. So the components that lead to outrage are not random, and they're not unknowable. Unknowability is one of the components, but we know the components. And you can sit there at your desk and think about a particular risk and ask yourself, is it, how voluntary is it? How natural is it? How familiar is it? And get a pretty good idea of how much outrage you're likely to be up against. That's, some of these are more important than others. If I had all the time in the world, I would, probably put most emphasis on trust and control and responsiveness. I think those are usually the big three. But every one of these 12 is occasionally one the biggie. So you want to look at all 12 and figure out how much outrage you are likely to be coping with. Next slide, please. If you're trying to reduce outrage, and it's only in outrage management that you try to do that, these are the core strategies. These are not easy to explain, and I haven't heard from Dave yet that I should shut up, so I'm keeping going. But I assume I'm out of time or almost out of time, so I'm not going to go into any detail on these. But they are crucial. Staking out the middle rather than the extreme. Don't say it's completely safe when it's a little dangerous. Acknowledging your prior misbehavior, acknowledging your current problems, what's difficult about managing this hazard, giving away the credit. If you're going to do something to reduce people's outrage, tell them that's why you did it. Don't pretend you did it voluntarily. Share control, and if you're unwilling to share control, set up accountability mechanisms so at least they can backseat drive. And finally, pay attention to unvoiced concerns and underlying motives, things like ego and guilt and shame and ideology, that often influence outrage quite apart from the 12 components of outrage. So, those are the core things you need to do if you're trying to calm people down. Now, in the last minute or so I have before I want to go to Q&A, let me make that a little bit more practical. Next and last slide, please. Here's a sort of more concrete way of talking to outraged people in terms of the order in which you do things. And this is true whether you've got hundreds of neighbors of your facility who imagine that your emissions are giving them cancer, or whether you've got an angry workforce that is upset about some risk at the facility. Or for that matter, whether you're dealing with your spouse or your adolescent child or a neighbor who's angry at you because they think you're too loud and you're running your music is making them irritated. Whenever you're talking to people who are outraged, the first thing you do is listen, and show that you're listening. Let them vent. Take notes while they vent. Don't check your emails. And don't take the microphone until they're demanding to hear your response. Let them talk until they are done. And that happens in stages. They'll vent for an hour, and finally they'll say, "Well, what have you got to say about all of this?" And you'll start to respond, and they'll want to vent some more. So it goes back and forth, but the venting is the priority early on. second stage is to echo very tentatively what you think you heard. Let me see if I understand what you're telling me. If I'm hearing you right, here are the three things you're most upset about, in what our company has been doing. So you echo what they have told you and check whether you've got it right. Okay. The third step is you agree with some of what they're saying. And I would argue and have argued to clients, there is always something outraged people are saying that you can agree with. Sometimes they're saying things you can agree with about the hazard. Always they're saying things you can agree with about the outrage. Almost always in a position to say, yes, we were very slow to listen to you. Yes, we have been less than fully candid about our emissions. Yes, it's true that when X happened, we mishandled it. You can almost always find ways that their outrage is solidly grounded in real things that happened. So agree with the outrage or aspects of the outrage, even when they're dead wrong about the hazard. And finally, eventually, of course, you're going to have to explain where you disagree, what they're saying, what they're claiming that you think is mistaken, and why you think it's mistaken. You need to get there, but you don't want to start there. And I think that's all the basics, and it's only the basics. And if I had a couple of hours, I could do more. And if I had a couple of days, I could do even more. And if you have a couple of days and you want to understand risk communication, I urge you to spend some time on my website and see if you can fill in these toolkits in a more detailed way. Next and last slide, please. There it is. I'm done. Dave, are you standing in front of the room, and are you going to MC the Q&A?
I am, Peter. Thank you very much for that. And please welcome. Thank you, Peter, for that. I'm glad you explained the concept of outrage. I think it's something that all of us in the room have contended with in our roles, and sometimes putting some science and some definitions to it is quite helpful. Great presentation and good timekeeping as well, I might add. We have got approximately 20 minutes for questions. There's a couple of mics in the aisles there. Do feel free to line up and ask some questions. We won't have any roving mics for this session. And I think we have our first question from the middle.
Well, firstly, I would like to thank you for the work that you've done and put in a plug for the book that you wrote with the AIHA in the late 80s and early 90s. That's when I first discovered your work, responding to community outrage. And I would say it's probably one of the most influential books I have read in my work as an occupational hygienist in terms of how I do what I do as opposed to what I do what I do. I was so impressed that I bought 100 of them from the AIHA and distributed them to my employees, my clients, and other colleagues. So I guess what I would say to this group is that is one of the shortest, most entertaining, and valuable books I have ever written, ever read for occupational hygiene practice. And I know it's been available for free to download off of your website, I guess, and at one point AIHA's website, and I would recommend it.
Alternatively, you can buy it on eBay for about $100, but it is free on my website.
I would highly recommend it. Thank you very much for what you've put out here today. It's tough
thank
to
you.
Do it in 20 minutes, but it's well worth another visit.
Thank you for your talk so far, much appreciated. My question's around occupational hygienists, and often we're brought in as SMEs to talk about the data, talk about the risks and so forth. And the question is really, quite often we form part of a larger group. So a number of stakeholders, whether it's a leadership team or whoever, that are obviously presenting, or trying to manage outrage or increase or talk to precautionary advocacy. So I wonder if you have any advice around how you can ensure a team of people like that are on the same page, or how you can ensure that you're working with each other to address some of the things that you were talking about, whether it's manage outrage or to increase, you know, perception around the risk.
But I mean, it's a very complicated question, but let me give you a few aspects of the answer that come immediately to mind. One is the most important team members to involve in outrage management are the ones you least want to involve. Sit there and think, who is going to hate this? Who is going to be really opposed to doing the things that you need to do in outrage management? Who's not going to want to admit what we screwed up? Who's not going to want to tell embarrassing pieces of truth that we've been withholding? That might be your company lawyer. That's probably going to be among the people, your company lawyer, that's going to have a reluctance to participate in this. It might be, one or another of the vice presidents. It might be the CEO. Whoever it is, whoever's going to be against it, get them involved in it. And this is the second point I'll make, do outrage management on behalf of outrage management. If you're talking to people who hate outrage management, and let me interrupt myself. One of the truths of high outrage situations is when people are outraged at your organization, the odds are overwhelming that the leadership of your organization is outraged at those people. They're accusing you of killing them. They're questioning your integrity. They're questioning your competence. Their children are refusing to talk to your children in school. You're facing all kinds of, and they're costing you money. I should mention that one. They might shut down your business. So you're feeling a whole lot of outrage at them. And this is important. These fights are not fights between outraged publics and calm organizations, companies or government agencies. They are almost always fights between outraged publics and outraged organizations. The difference is their outrage is hot and your outrage tends to be cold. So you get this horrible dynamic where they're yelling and you're being coldly hostile and passive aggressive. So that's what you're fighting when you try to, when you try to put together a team. The biggest burden is going to be some of the people on your team don't want to do outrage management. And you're going to have to do outrage management on behalf of outrage management. You're going to have to address their outrage about outrage. There's more that could be said, I think, but that's what comes to mind first in terms of team building on behalf of outrage management. Don't leave the lawyer out of the room. Don't leave the opponents of outrage management out of the room. Get them involved and work with them.
So my question comes around risk perception and hazard perception that you spoke about earlier. Hearing in the mining industry in Western Australia, we have a lot of problems in around risk perception and risk management. One of the key elements of that would be in around the one fibre can kill it. So when we mine here in Western Australia, we cut into naturally occurring asbestos or mineral fibres. Everybody gets very emotive and very upset when that happens. Now, there would be formal education programs in place. There would be inductions, orientations, training to try to address all of that. What you put up on the slides earlier on in terms of bullet points were fantastic. There are great some leading points to go in. And I suppose my question is there any formal program or any formal risk perception and outrage management tools or software or resources that we could use to formally address hazard and outrage? And if so, could you share those with us? Acknowledging Brad's brilliant plug for all your work earlier on, I'm sure a lot of the information's in there, but is there any formal programs or any formal management plans that hygienists can use to manage outreach?
You're talking about asbestos in particular or more broadly?
More broadly, it could be E. coli in water, it could be hexavalent chromium, it's in general. I'm looking for like a holistic management plan or resources to be able to use to manage outreach.
I mean, I think the bottom line answer is no. I mean, for sure, there are all kinds of tools to help you explain hazard. But what I'm, you know, I mean, one of my core points is explaining hazard is a, although it's a necessary part of risk communication, it's not very useful in order to reduce outrage. So, you know, I mean, if outrage management is your problem, yeah, you're still going to have to explain the hazard. You're going to have to, you know, give all kinds of information about why you are convinced that the hazard, whether it's asbestos fibers or, you know, whatever it is, that this hazard is less serious than they think it is. You're going to need to explain that, and you will find pretty much for any specific hazard, I think you will find at least slide sets and other kinds of materials that you can use to explain the data. The problem is that explaining the data is a very small piece of the task when people are upset. When people are upset, they don't want to hear the data. You know, they don't want to know they're not endangered. And this is important to understand. If, you know, the more upset you are, the more you kind of attached to your outrage and you're attached to your high hazard perception. So you don't want to be reassured. You're too angry to want to be reassured. So managing the outrage comes before explaining the hazard. And managing the outrage is not something you can do with you know, a prefab tool. It's, you know, you're gonna have to do that by building a trusting relationship with stakeholders. And that's going to be much more interpersonal. I have to say, and I don't want to run too long, and you know, I tend to answer questions ad nauseum, I produced decades ago software on how to measure outrage, on how to assess outrage, and it's available on my website as well. Although it's software that was written for obsolete technology. So you need very sophisticated people now to help you use obsolete technology that's outdated. But you can download it and play with it. I download it on a gaming machine rather than rather than screwing up your company's computer system. But it's not software you can use with audiences. It's software you can use with your team to figure out how high the outrage is and where it's coming from and what you might do to reduce it. So, I mean, that's a tool I tried to create so that I could retire, basically, so that people who wanted to bring me in could bring the software in instead. I think it works beautifully. It never sold very well, which is why it's freeware on my website now. But it doesn't answer your question. It's not software that the public can use in order to calm down. It's software that you can use in order to figure out what you did to rile them up and what you can do to turn this awful situation around.
Thanks, Peter. I'll break out my Atari 64. Thank you.
Thanks, Rory. Jeremy.
Great. Okay. Look, I had the pleasure of listening to you way back in the 80s, and now I'm sitting here with the
second generation.
I had the pleasure of listening to you back in the 80s, and now I'm sitting here with the second generation, and they're listening to you now too. So longevity, great thing. Look, my question is, I remember back then that you drilled down on a few of those risk factors that, or how the perception of risk, how it's developed in people's minds, in particular, voluntary versus involuntary risks. And the other thing I'd like you to maybe just give a little bit more detail on is just the we often fall into this thing where we compare risks to natural risks and try and calm people down that way. And I can't remember whether you thought that was an effective mechanism or not.
Okay, I mean, voluntariness is a pretty important component of outrage. I mean, if you think about the difference between deciding to go on a skiing trip on the one hand, and on the other hand, having somebody strap slippery sticks to the bottoms of your feet and push you down a mountain, one of those is recreation and the other is assault with a deadly weapon. A great deal depends on whether you decided to take the risk or someone else decided to impose that risk on you. The distinction between natural and industrial risks is, I think, usually less important, but it is sometimes very important, and people are quite capable. For example, I worked early in my career on radon gas, and radon gas is sometimes natural, in which case people shrug it off and it's hard to persuade them to take it seriously. But if it's a decay product of mine tailings, then suddenly it's a big deal. Because it's that damn mining company that is exposing me to radon gas, not God. And I am much more forgiving of God than I am of your mining company. So you're quite right. Those are two important issues. I think where you were going, and or at least where I want to go with your question, is it is not usually effective to compare a high hazard versus a low hazard risk in order to say what we're doing is less dangerous than this other thing, when they differ in the opposite direction on outrage. This will be clearer with an example. If people come to a public meeting and they are upset about the risk from your factory, and you say to them, you took a bigger risk driving to this meeting, and you're taking a much bigger risk having a cigarette during the break than the risk from our emissions. And let's assume that's true in hazard terms. Let's assume that your emissions are less dangerous than driving and less dangerous than smoking. It doesn't matter, because driving is voluntary and smoking is voluntary and your emissions are not. And they control the car and they control their cigarette and they don't have any control over your emissions. And there are a variety of other differences. Your emissions are dreaded and driving is not, and smoking is not. Your emissions may be unfamiliar and driving and smoking are not. So what you're doing is you're taking a high hazard, low outrage risk and comparing it with a low hazard, high outrage risk in order to say our hazard is lower than your hazard. But people's hazard perception is based on outrage. And in outrage terms, you're lying. Your hazard is higher outrage than their hazard. And they will react as if you were lying. So if you're going to do a hazard comparison, you have to do a hazard comparison of two risks that are roughly equal in outrage. And then you can do it. You can say our emissions are less hazardous than they were before we put in the scrubber. You can do hazard comparisons, but not hazard comparisons where the outrage is cutting in the opposite direction. I'm not sure that was your question, but if it was, I hope I answered it.
Thank you very much, Peter. My name's Kevin Hedges. And my question had to do with the intersection between what you've shared and advocacy. Many of us in the room are involved in advocacy. You know, we want to change, whether we want a lower exposure limit or lobby for, you know, asbestos not to be used in Sri Lanka or Vietnam. Have you got any tips, techniques, or suggestions to those of us that are involved in advocacy?
Yes, I mean, you're quite right. I have focused, certainly in the Q&A, I focused on outrage management, and in the last half of my presentation, I focused on outrage management. Obviously, precaution advocacy is a completely different kind of risk communication. And I mean, there's a lot on my website about it. If I had to pick one as well, I mean, the aspect of precaution advocacy I already mentioned in the presentation is apathy. You know, is low outrage is another name for apathy. So if you're talking to apathetic people, and in precaution advocacy, you are talking to apathetic people. You're trying to arouse outrage. You have to keep your message short. You have to make it interesting. You have to repeat it a lot. Precaution advocacy is also a matter of I think very often of taking advantage of teachable moments. There's not much value in talking to people when they're not listening. So you wait for a moment when they are listening, when something has happened that makes the risk you want to warn them about temporarily more salient, and shoot your wad then, when there's more attention, rather than speaking into the void when they're not paying attention. There are way more complex tools of precaution advocacy. I mean, very often appealing to needs or appealing to emotions or appealing to things other than evidence needs to come first. Certainly, activists understand that, you know, in order to mobilize outrage about a hazard they think is serious, they don't go in mostly saying the hazard is serious. They go in mostly saying that goddamn company, look what they're doing to you. You can't trust them. They're lying through their teeth. And they, you know, they work their way into their contention that the hazard is serious. So, you know, if you're doing precaution advocacy, whether it's with with inside your organization, we ought to be taking better precautions. We ought to be reducing our emissions, or whether you're advocating to government or you're advocating to your workforce to wear their PPE. I mean, there are all kinds of opportunities in industrial hygiene to do precaution advocacy, and as a rule, you need to find something to appeal to other than your conviction that the hazard is high. And you need to arouse concern, arouse interest, arouse outrage, and then, in the context of having done that, you can begin to present evidence that the hazard is deserving of their attention. Don't start with the hazard.
Thank you very much. Thanks, David.
Fantastic. So that comes to an end, our session. Peter, you've been really generous with your time. So please join me in thanking Peter Sandman for the session.
Thank you. My pleasure. I'm going to sign off now.
Thank you.